Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
From Nice Guy Productions world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and we are back once again with the fun size version of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And asking your questions is producer Joe Russo. Joe, should we change the name to Postmortem AMAA? Ask me almost anything?
You mean because there's the big bad buffer, which is me in between?
That's right.
I mean, look, we're pretty good about answering almost everything we get. The only ones we usually skimp over are things that we've covered before, right? You know? And very few in between. So I would say it's, yeah, the almost is pretty encompassing, I would say. So before we dive into the questions, I wanted to dive into your experience watching Jaws in 3D.
Okay. I'm very excited about it. I had, you know, this was a special event screening, like when I went to the 40th anniversary screening of The Thing, which was a disaster.
Yeah.
This, I love Jaws. I've seen it dozens of times. I know it by heart. It's one of the most perfect movies ever made. And I'm not usually a huge fan of 3D movies. There's always ghost images or double imaging. Just it's never really sharp or bright enough. So I went in with low expectations, and oh my God, the movie is completely new again.
Yeah,
it worked gangbusters. It looked like Spielberg designed every shot for three dimensions. The depth is incredible, and it's not gimmicky at all because it wasn't shot for 3D. There's right. No paddle ball going into the camera, things like that. But it was a thrilling experience, and Adam Green and Dave Parker were at the same show sitting behind us, so all of us were so thrilled with how new life was brought to something that is a classic and will always be a great film in ways that I never imagined were possible.
I wish it was playing for a longer stretch of time, because I don't think I'm going to be able to get to it, but having seen your review and hearing it now too, gosh, I wish I had. It reminds me of when I saw a test of when they were converting Titanic to 3D under James Cameron's supervision.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we saw the demo for it, and I just was like blown away. But, you know, I think Cameron and Spielberg composed their shots with such three dimensionality already.
Yeah, the compositions are filled with depth and layers anyway. But to see it, and a lot of 3D looks like cardboard cutouts. They're layered, sure, like an old Popeye cartoon was shot.
Right, right.
But not this. This is incredibly robust.
It sounds like it's really special. I hopefully I can catch it. If not, you know, hopefully they'll bring it back. You know, when it turns, oh my God, it's going to turn 50. So
wow.
pretty soon it's getting there.
Yeah.
All right. Let's jump into some questions, shall we?
Let's do it.
All right. Blair asks, and this is a little bit of follow-up, how did Tales from the Crypt come about for you? How were you approached? And did you get any say over which story you directed?
Last question first. No, I did not get any say. What, on a television series, they basically have the scripts written, not all at once. It's piecemeal. You agree to a time period rather than a specific script. I had worked with producer Gil Adler before on Freddy's Nightmares. I did an episode called Killer Instinct on Freddy's Nightmares. And so Gil and I had worked together well. The Stand had come out and become quite a sensation. And I was thrilled to be invited to join the group on Tales from the Crypt, which included a heady collection of filmmakers in the genre. So that was how I got involved with it and had a blast doing it. And it's one of the few that was a little more comedic. So I actually hired stand-up comics to play the leads, Rita Rudner and Richard Lewis. So it was a great experience, very fast. And very much on the run, but really, really fun.
And if you guys haven't had a chance to check out our Tales from the Crypt episode from a couple weeks ago, where Mick interviewed Gil Adler and Alan Katz, it's really worth it. It's a great, great, great episode.
Yeah, they really open up in ways you don't expect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Another little bit of follow-up from our last AMA, David asks, in a recent podcast, you discussed a number of screen-used props that you've retained from some of your previous films. My question is, if you could have any horror-related screen-used prop from any other iconic or favorite horror film, what would it be?
I don't know. You know, I've got the butcher knife from Psycho 4, but I'd love to have the original from the original Psycho.
That's pretty cool.
Perhaps a life mask where they designed the makeups for Boris Karloff. Would love to have that. I know Rick Baker has life masks of Karloff and Chaney and Tor Johnson.
Wow.
Something like that, you know. I don't know. I haven't really thought about
it. I was thinking Freddy's glove.
Oh, there you go. That's an obvious.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, that feels like something that if someone saw it, they would know instantaneously what it was and what it was from.
Yeah, and I sure wouldn't mind having a dinosaur from Jurassic Park. One of the little ones.
One of the little ones, yeah. I will say, and I'm sure they're redesigned and such, but you know, when you walk into K&B, they have all sorts of you know, these redesigned, repurposed, lifelike characters from Jaws and Predators, and
yeah,
and they had a T-Rex there too, which was
amazing. Which was really cool. Yeah, all of the big makeup effects houses have tributes to favorite things or things of their own. I remember working with Stan Winston and going into Stan Winston Studios and seeing all of the stuff from, they had figures from Amazing Stories, an episode that I wrote, and all of the makeup effects guys just love the work so much. And they're there because they love monsters and movies and creatures and things. And to see the care with which they adorn their walls and halls is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it really is for movie fans like being a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
All right. Steven asks, how is the project you're currently writing coming along?
Coming along well as of this date. We've finished writing the first draft of the pilot to be turned in. There was a lot of writing and rewriting and writing and rewriting. It's just been turned into the network, and we are waiting for their feedback.
Isn't that always the Schrodinger's cat moment, isn't it? It could, right now it could be anything. They could love it, they could hate it, they could green light it instantly, they could give you notes, they could, it's literally, you don't know what is in that box. It could be any response.
Exactly. But we're pretty excited about it, and I know they've been anticipating. It's taken a little longer than expected to deliver the draft for a number of reasons, but it is in their hot little hands for their weekend read, and we will see what happens from there. And it could be any number of things. Like you said, it could be they love it. It could be they hate it. It could be they love what it could be and what changes, or it's too expensive, or why don't we do this? But it is for a new anthology series. So it doesn't necessarily lay the groundwork for a whole group of characters and circumstances.
Right. Right. It's more about setting the tone and atmosphere for the series to come.
Right. And setting up a Cracker Jack first story.
Absolutely. Well, I'm excited for you. That's a great place to be. And it's a exciting place to be.
Thank you. All digits are crossed.
Yes. Mine too for you.
Thank you.
All right. Jason asks, when writing horror, how do you come up with set pieces for scares and gore?
Interesting. Trying to tap into what's personal to you. You know, in telling a story, you're telling a story in which you are every one of the characters from the inside. A bad movie, the characters are all from the outside. They are all prototypes. They are all people who do and say things that they would do under normal circumstances in every other movie or TV show. So approaching storytelling from the inside is the first step. And what scares you will probably scare other people as well. If you can draw from experience, even imagined experience, that's something. But, you know, we fear pain, death, illness, for ourselves and for the loved ones around us. If you can make it personal and you can approach it from a unique perspective, you know, when I was doing Chocolate, people didn't think of it as a horror story, but that was my first Masters of Horror episode that I wrote and directed based on a short story. And I approached something, a story I'd never seen before, where someone experiences what it is like to commit a brutal and bloody murder. From the hot blood running down your arms from the blade that pierces the abdomen and all of that. And I hadn't read or seen that story before. And that's the starting point.
Yeah.
You know, the more personal you can make it and the more fearlessly you attack what's inside your gut and your heart, I think the more successful a chance you have at telling a successful, frightening story.
Yeah. I mean, what you brought up on Chocolate is kind of how I approach it. I don't know if you think this way as well, but to me, the themes and the challenges that your characters have to face throughout those themes sometimes open the doors for those particular types of scares and set pieces that they'll have to face. Right. You know, for instance, the movie that we wrote that just shot is an online dating horror story. So a lot of the scares are all built around taking what are kind of classical dating tropes and trying to find nightmarish spins for them, right?
That's a really great point, is taking a set piece that may start out seeming familiar, but taking it in a dreadful place that it has not gone before.
Yeah, exactly.
A surprising place.
Yeah. And I think, but you know, but it has to be rooted in the theme and the journey and the character's journey and such.
Yeah. Host is a great example of that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like we're going to do a movie about characters on Zoom, right? Doing a seance on Zoom. How can we then extrapolate scares from that premise and from those challenges that those characters are going to face? I think, you know, because this comes up a lot when, especially like talking to producers and executives about horror stories in their infancy, you know, they're like, well, where are the scares? It's like the scares will come as we continue to explore the world.
Yeah,
you know?
The storyline is what comes first. And then you take those tributaries that lead you to the hearts of darkness.
Yes, I agree. So hopefully that helps, Jason. Tiny Vikings writes, we love Tiny Vikings, always good questions.
Always
Tiny Vikings writes, what makes a great family-friendly horror film? Is it more of a tone and vibe that stays lighthearted? Is it more comedic? Also, now that Freeform has announced that Hocus Pocus will play a bunch of times during 31 Nights of Halloween. I'd like to know what Mick is going to do with all those royalties.
Well, royalties from a film that came out in 1993, they shrink every year.
Well, because I think probably people don't understand is they get kind of halved over time, right?
I mean, right, it's like, every year.
There's there's like a percentage drop every time it gets recirculated, I think.
Right, right.
And
by now, those, especially on cable TV, commercial cable TV, it costs more to cut the check than the amount of the check. So, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it is not vast. But as far as a family-friendly horror movie, there are a lot of entry-level horror movies, and Hocus Pocus is a good example of that. You know, it's the characters are young. That's an important stepping-off point. But it's also something that respects the young and the parents as well. You know, a true family movie is not just for children. It's something that can be enjoyed by their parents as well, so that everybody can go to the movies or sit in front of the set and enjoy it together. Obviously, sex and violence are at a minimum, and that's a choice. The ratings board has a lot to do with that. But if you know the audience you're going after, you put yourself in the position of that. If your aim is at a 14-year-old, remember the inner 14-year-old that you've embraced and you have not given up. It's one of the great things about being able to work in the creative arts is, in many ways, you're not forced to grow up. You're not forced to quash that child that lives within you, the imaginative child that plays games and tells stories. But a sense of humor is definitely a good way to lead them in. Make the scares scary, but you're not out to gross someone out, gross out the audience, or horrify them with vivisection. You know, you just need to know who your audience is for, and then we can lead them down the path. In their adult years.
Open the doors. That's how it worked for me, was, you know, movies like Hocus Pocus and Emblem movies and such kind of paving the way towards spookier and spookier stories. So
I mean, if it attracts you at an early age, it usually stays with you, and it deepens and darkens, and thank goodness that in the world of international horror, there's plenty of horror that's intended not just for adolescence, which is, you know, going from childhood Hocus Pocus to adolescence and the splatter movies.
Sure.
Is, you know, that's a really recreational embracing of that which your parents would not.
Right.
But then moving on towards deeper, darker stories that are much more human and internal and psychologically based, which is still embraced all over the world, more so than in the United States.
There is literally horror for every age.
There is indeed.
Yep.
Goosebumps right. From on.
Exactly. All right. Bark Eater Productions writes, with Hollywood full of so many aspiring and established screenwriters, why do you think the studios keep cranking out awful remakes that no one asks for?
Well, because they're successful.
Yeah. You know,
they don't do what they think is the best storytelling. They put out the movies that they know how to sell or think they know how to sell and are familiar with. And IP, that dreaded term of IP.
Intellectual property.
Yes, intellectual property. A familiarity is what they're going for. Most of the studio executives have no knowledge or love for the horror genre other than the big titles, the Screams and the Freddies and the, you know, Stephen King and franchises that they have had success with before.
Right.
There's a lot of really brilliant stuff being written and a lot of it really being made as well, but it's in a very independent sense and it's hard to find that stuff.
Right.
As far as the studios go, they want the tried and true because they don't know how to recognize what's new and exciting, and then how to market something that's not like everything else out there.
They're very risk averse.
That's a good term.
Yep. Very risk averse, and intellectual property is safe. If it doesn't work, they can point to the intellectual property and say, but it worked before.
Right.
Which is a lot easier.
Try it again.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot safer way to try and keep your job than taking a chance on something new and having it not work.
Yeah. I mean, I love something like The Studio Will Make a Quiet Place, like nothing else out there.
Yeah.
And it was a huge hit, and it was fantastic. Of course, then they did Quiet Place 2 because they'd had a hit and they thought they could replicate the experience.
And now they're doing a spinoff and a third one and blah, 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 blah. Yep. Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
So onwards with the arts.
I'm still all in on who's on first. Yeah,
that's right. All right. Gary wants to know, what motivates you to continue telling stories?
The ability to. You know, I've always loved it. It's exciting. I've actually made a career out of doing that on the screen and on the page. And I just love telling stories. It's something that's innate from the dawn of man, from cave paintings on, the ability to come up with stories that will take the viewer or the listener or the reader in directions they don't expect, and to maybe relate situations or emotions together. You know, it's a way to be tribal without being in the same room together. So just being able to continue doing that for a living, basically, I've often referred to it as dreaming awake. My job is to dream awake.
I think it's also interesting that you've said in past as well that you don't really actually dream very often.
I remember. Yeah.
I feel like every night I'm putting on shows in my head. I can't remember most of them, but I know I've dreamt, because I usually wake up exhausted from them.
I would love to do that. And I'm sure I dream. You know, scientifically, they say everybody dreams a lot every night.
Yeah.
It's just that I rarely remember them. Sometimes I'll wake up feeling, oh, this dream. But as soon as I come awake, it's like smoke. It's gone.
Yeah.
But I rarely remember dreams that I recall.
I don't know if you've ever found yourself in this position as well, but, you know, in response to Gary's question, you know, now that I'm a few years into my career, when I do have those crises of faith of should I keep doing this, I also then realize I don't think I'm equipped to do anything else.
It's great to be limited, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
Many abilities.
I guess I have to keep going, because this is the only thing I know how to do.
Well, the other thing too is that I would do it if I wasn't doing it for a living.
Right.
Whether it's just on the page or getting a bunch of friends and family together to create movies or visual stories. I would do that regardless of whether I was getting paid for it or not.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'd be very unhappy if I all of a sudden got, you know, a 9-to-5 tomorrow and just stopped making movies and stopped watching movies. I think I would be very unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I usually do that math in my head, and then I'm like, okay, well, I guess I got to write the next one.
But it's also the writing of short fiction and novels as well. The reason I did that was in between film projects, because there is nothing between me and the screen or the page. And writing prose is the final product.
Yeah.
And it allows you to exercise those creative muscles without interference.
That is a creative challenge I have not wanted to take on just yet. And I certainly respect everyone who has done it. And you're quite good at it. So
thank you.
I find it intimidating, the idea of writing prose fiction, but
it's fun.
You know, maybe down the road I'll explore it. Not yet. Okay. we've been asked this question before in different ways. But I have kind of a different spin on it that I think might be worth talking about. But Peter writes, Mick and Joe, I'm a screenwriter and author in LA with a couple of credits to my name, but feel the only way to level up and get out of the assistant realm is to start putting whatever small amount of money I can towards producing my own short and then eventually a feature horror film. Do you have any advice? I think, Mick, you know, I think there's a lot of people who put an emphasis on making a short or making an independent feature as like the be all end all. Like once I do that, I will have quote unquote made it in some regard. Right.
It's a step and it's a calling card.
Right. Right.
You know, it is, you know, having an independent feature, a micro budget feature finished, even if it's terrific, where are people going to see it? What's the platform? Who's going to buy it? Who's going to distribute it?
Right.
How can it reach eyeballs?
Yeah.
And even more so for a short film.
Yeah.
It's great to do that, but consider it a calling card. If you're lucky, it's Blair Witch Project, you know, and explodes into a theatrical experience.
Phenomenon. Yes.
Yeah. But at the very least, you'll have a calling card that shows what you're capable of doing with limited resources. Now, nobody who's hiring you is going to give a damn about your resources because they see things made at all budget levels and they don't, they can't use that as an excuse. Well, it would be better, except I only had $10,000 to make this movie. Well,
then it's
not better. And it's not just because of the money. You should have made your project that could be well made at that budget.
And that's where I think I'm getting at is I feel like, you know, if you are writing and you're not finding success yet with your writing, I think keep writing, keep sharpening those skills, keep getting better, because that is a very cost effective way to continue to improve your storytelling skills. Because
are more likely to buy a script that they like than they are to hire a director who has only made shorts.
I think so. It's 100%. Nobody wants to hire a first-time director. And even if you do a feature, I think the thing that people forget is once you've done it, you essentially have to start over and do it again, right?
Yeah.
And we just got a note from our post-producer, Chris Price. Yes, I agree. Filmmaking is accumulative. The more you do it, the better you get. And the better you get at it, whether it be writing or actually directing, the more likely you will find the success you want. I think putting too much emphasis on doing one movie and having that be the thing that changes everything is actually can be a very unhealthy way to view the creative process.
Yeah, you can jump onto YouTube and see hundreds of thousands of feature films that have not gotten farther than YouTube. Some of them really good and some are calling cards.
I agree. So I think Peter, you know, if you're not getting the traction you want on writing just yet, keep going, keep pushing, keep exploring creatively.
And it depends on what your goal is. Is your goal to be a great screenwriter or is your goal to be a director?
Yes.
For me and for you, Joe, we both got our opportunities as writers first before given an opportunity to direct.
Right. Right. So one can pave the way into the other and we're great examples of that. But I guess what I'm just trying to say is like, just because you've written one script or just because you've directed a short or directed a feature, that's not necessarily going to be the be all end all thing. And, you know, you should be ready to make multiple shorts, multiple features, write multiple scripts, and eventually those right set of circumstances will happen.
Look, I've been doing this now, oh my God, for 40 years, and it's never easier.
You know,
it never gets easier.
Yeah, yeah,
to start over every time.
Every time. That's I think, you know, it's, and I kept waiting for it to happen in between those last couple of movies. Like, oh, when is it going to get easier? And it doesn't. It's literally you start over every single time.
Yeah. And you do. So, and it's great because it makes you do your best work. It doesn't let you get lazy unless, you know, your first movie comes out and it makes $200 million. Then you get a lot of opportunities thrown at you. And in some people's hands, they become quite laissez-faire about it.
Yeah, but I think there's also, I mean, for the good filmmakers, there's the challenge of besting yourself, right?
Yes.
So, and that's it's a whole new set of challenges. But either way, you're starting over and there's a great challenge ahead. So keep in mind as you head towards making that jump into directing.
Yeah.
Okay, our last question. Sam wants to know, do you have any theories as to why it is that so few mummy movies have been made over the years when compared to the countless other classic monster movies, vampires, werewolves, Frankenstein's monster, etc.? The mummy is such an iconic monster, and although it regularly appears in horror and Halloween imagery, actual mummy films are few and far between. Why do you think this is? Why is the mummy such an iconic and timeless character, so underrepresented in the horror genre? Is it time once again for this undead icon to shamble out of its sarcophagus onto the silver screen?
So we get our long questions when they come in email, right?
That's right. And that is an edited down version. again, filtered, but I think the question is still very clear and still very relevant. Nick,
There's a very easy answer, and then I'll elaborate on it. The easy answer is mummies just aren't scary.
Yeah.
You know, I made a joke with Stephen King once, and it ended up in one of his books. I think it was From a Buick 8, where the people are talking about the mummy. And I just said, uh-oh, here comes the mummy. We'd better walk a little faster. It's a shambling corpse in dust and rags.
Yeah,
that doesn't have a lot to do. Now, I have worked on two mummy films that never got made.
That's right.
One of them, Clive Barker, had come up with an idea for the mummy that was totally unlike anything else you'd ever seen in not just any mummy film, but any other movie. And he came up with the story, and I wrote the screenplay. And I knew when this was being written, I thought, why is Universal funding this? They're never going to make this. And we turned in the script, and to this day, I've never heard back. So that's how much it scared them. But there was a period of time when Clive was going to direct it, then potentially I was going to direct it because he got busy on something else. And then George Romero was going to write and direct a version of The Mummy that was more in line with the classic Universal original, the mummy goat. But that was a really good script. It was a lot of fun, but he was given a choice of doing that or a Go movie. And so he took the Go movie and he had to leave that project. So it came into my hands. I was hired to rewrite it and to direct it as a $15 million mummy movie.
Right.
Well, that's when Sid Sheinberg was kind of booted from running Universal Studios. He was the president of the company. And they gave him a producing job. So he could choose anything in the pipeline and take it on. So he chose The Mummy and decided to turn it into Raiders of the Lost Mummy and made the Brendan Fraser movie version, which was an adventure story, which maybe The Mummy is better suited as an adventure story than as a horror story. Although they keep trying to do that.
It's certainly better than the action version they tried.
Yeah, the Tom Cruise version.
Which we will not get into because we try not to be negative about movies on this podcast.
But that again is an adventure story.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Brendan Fraser one was much stronger overall. And by the way, has grown into like having quite a cult following. I mean, there are people who are my age and younger that worship that movie.
Yeah. So you didn't see Raiders of the Lost Ark first.
Well, I did. But,
okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. But, you know, I think when you're a kid and you love Indiana Jones,
yeah, of course.
Sudden another Indiana Jones like movie comes along, of course you embrace it, you know. For a long time that was probably like the unofficial fourth Indiana Jones movie, you know.
True enough.
I have a question about, and I'm curious to get your thought. Do you think that one of the reasons mummy movies, like you said, they're not scary because, you know, you can outrun them, right? But do you think that one of the reasons the mummy movies kind of faded out is because zombie movies replaced them?
Yeah, zombies are more ferocious. Zombies started out as shambling, slow creatures, and more often than not still are, until...
And also the undead, right?
Yeah, yeah, they are the undead. They're the unwrapped undead. So, you know, you had Danny Boyle come along with 28 Days Later, and there were fast zombies. Abby Bernstein, who wrote my biography, actually did a version of the mummy script before George Romero did for Universal. Yeah. And she introduced the idea of a fast mummy, which nobody had done before.
That's pretty cool.
So that was way back then, and nothing came of that. But yeah, I mean, zombies are much more interesting than mummies. And, you know, I've certainly had my fill of zombie movies until once in a great while somebody does something brand new and exciting with it. And it's like, oh, okay, there's still life in the undead.
But that's something I just, while you were talking, I kind of thought, you know, could that have been one of the reasons why? Have they just been, were they literally market corrected and replaced?
You know? Maybe so. Maybe
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
Because when you think of a mummy, you do think of a slow, shambling, dusty creature.
But so I guess that being said, and your comment about zombies somehow always seeming to find a way to surprise you, I wouldn't necessarily say we're closing the sarcophagus on mummies, right? Like there still might be a way to bring
somebody can breathe new life into it. Believe me, the Clive Barker version would have breathed very new life into it in ways no one would have expected.
Absolutely. Well, and look at what Lee Whannell did with The Invisible Man. I mean, he was able to completely re-energize what was otherwise probably a very dusty old Universal IP. So
yeah, that was dead for decades. You know, yeah. John Carpenter did the Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase, but that's a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So maybe someone will find a way to unravel this mummy mystery. All right. On that note, Mick, thank you for another wonderful Ask Mick Anything. And thanks to all our fans for sending great questions.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you, everybody, all of the listeners. And please, if you're enjoying the show, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and wherever you get your pods. So, Joe, how can everybody get their questions to ask me almost anything?
Almost anything. You can send your questions to our new, and though at this point it's not so new anymore, our email address, askmickanything@gmail.com, or you can find Mick on Twitter and Instagram @MickGarrisPM, or you can find me @JoeRussoTweets and @JoeRussoGram respectively, and send us your questions there.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.